All right, I'm gonna call this meeting of the Elections Committee to order. Hello, members. A quorum is present. The first item on the agenda is the approval of the minutes of the March 1st meeting of the Elections Committee. Do I have minutes? Oh, yeah, I saw them over here. Yeah, anybody want to move? Representative Davis, I don't know.
Chair, I read the minutes. They look good. I'll also move.
Okay, thank you. Representative Davis has moved approval of the minutes. Any discussion? Okay, seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Okay, the minutes are adopted. The first item on the agenda is House File 558, Representative Frederick's bill. Representative Frederick, would you like to move that House File 558 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill?
That is my motion, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. So Representative Frederick has moved House File 558 be laid over for possible inclusion. Did you want to move the DE3 amendment at this point?
Yes, please, Mr. Chair.
Okay. And is this just to put the bill in the shape you would like?
The DE amendment kind of reorganizes some of the language, and then yes, I'll just say yes.
Okay, thank you. You can describe it when you describe the bill. Representative Frederick has moved the DE3 amendments. Any discussion? Okay, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, the bill is in the shape you would like. Representative Frederick, please describe your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. So in the state of Minnesota, early voting looks like it's early absentee voting. We have to put your ballot in an envelope, and then you can turn it in at your county seat. What this bill seeks to do is, during an 18-day period prior to Election Day, have true early voting where you go in, you fill out a ballot, you put that ballot in a tabulator, you get the little notice on the tabulator saying it was counted, you get your sticker, and you can walk away, just like what you can do on actual voting day. That is the core of what this bill does, is just allow, during an 18-day window, for people to show up, vote in person, and have their voice be heard. The reason that is 18 days, if that seems kind of like a weird number, some of it started at 30 days. We wanted it for a month, got feedback from the counties, initially went down to 3 weeks, but then the request was that if 18 days means it starts on a Friday, and that there are 3 weekends leading up to the actual election day itself. Other provisions within this bill outline the hours that are needed to be open during the week, and then it also includes one weekday evening until 8 p.m. at the county's discretion, but it has to be the same weekday for both weeks leading up to Election Day for there to be some consistency in the hours, and then every Saturday leading up to Election Day, and then the Sunday before Election Day itself is also mandating that the hours be open. There are those within the state that it doesn't matter what day that we open up early voting, they will be there. But we know that as we get closer to Election Day itself, more and more people will show up to vote, which is why there's that increased hours in adding that Sunday before Election Day. And then one provision that working with the stakeholders was on the Monday before Election Day is the busiest day of voting within the counties. And so taking into feedback that we got from them is that we are allowing, with the DE amendment, we are rolling that back to 3 p.m. on the Monday before Election Day itself, which gives the counties time to be able to get ready for the big day, big Election Day itself. That it was just a effort to work with as many stakeholders we could to get this bill crafted. It allows pop-up locations for voting. It allows the tribes to reach out to the county auditor, the county elections administrator, requesting an election location within the tribes. And the goal is just to be able to expand voting and access and make it easier for people's voice to be heard.
All right, thank you, Representative Frederick. Two people who've signed up to testify, Nicole Freeman and Michael Stanberger. Nicole Freeman, would you like to come forward, just identify yourself for the record, and then proceed with your testimony? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Nicole Freeman, Office of the Secretary of State. I want to say thank you to Representative Frederick for bringing us House File 558 today. Early voting provides additional flexibility for voters who wish to vote in person, allowing them to stop in when it's convenient for them during the 18 days before Election Day. It gives them the peace of mind knowing that their ballot was accepted then and there, and if there are any issues, they can correct them on their ballot. Not only does this process not only is this process advantageous to voters, but it also streamlines the administration of voters before Election Day. The safeguards and checks and balances in our system that exist on Election Day are all present through the early voting process. The Office of the Secretary of State appreciates the expansion of early voting hours across the state in this bill. And while we applaud this expansion, we ask the committee to consider allowing early voting until 5 p.m. on Monday before Election Day. Voters have told us they prefer voting in circumstances that mirror Election Day conditions. They've done this by turning out in turning out to vote absentee in person in high numbers the week prior to Election Day, when local jurisdictions may offer direct balloting. In 2022, 47% of voters who voted in person before Election Day turned out during those last 7 days before election. So to close, thank you again to the committee for hearing this bill, and we hope you will support it. Thank you.
Thank you, Nicole Freeman. Next, I have Michael Stahlberger. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Michael Stahlberger. I'm Director of Property and Environmental Resources for Blue Earth County. In that purview, I am the elections administrator for about 38,000 registered voters in the county. I am representing the Minnesota Association of County Officers today, MACO. MACO represents all 87 counties' auditors, treasurers, recorders, and finance officers, and that also includes the elections administrators countywide, statewide, excuse me. MACO's platform this year includes a provision on the fair and impartial stewardship of elections, and with that, we look for any opportunities to enhance the efficiency and administration of elections. MACO does support the efficiencies created under House File 558 by implementing early voting. As was already mentioned, under current law, voters think they are voting early when they are truly voting by absentee ballot, and that requires them to complete an absentee ballot application. This process will mimic more of the 7-day direct balloting process, which Ms. Freeman mentioned. It has been gaining popularity in the last several elections. Voters do wish to continue to feed their ballots directly into a tabulator and to receive that validation that their vote has been counted, and early voting will allow us to do that for a greater period of time. We do appreciate all the work that's been put into this bill, especially related to the start of the early voting period. We've had many conversations with Representative Fredericks in regard to that. And the 18 days does appear to be that magic number of where administrators can be well prepared and have all of our equipment tested thoroughly for the election while still giving plenty of time for voters to participate in the early voting process. We also very much support and appreciate the closing of the early voting period at 3 p.m. on the day before the election. And while we do recognize that is a busy day for voters wishing to vote early, there are many, many checks and balances and safeguards that election administrators need to complete before they roll over to actual voting on Election Day. And 3 p.m. does give us some very valuable time to complete those tasks to make sure that we have all of our rosters and records in order before Election Day begins, quite early for us election administrators. I will leave with a little concern, and we'd like to continue the conversation regarding the mandatory expanded hours on weekends and into the weeknights. Elections are different. Each election brings its own story and paints its own picture. And we would like to have some flexibility in terms of the hours that are required for expanded early voting. Take, for example, a primary election. We don't have as many voters on Saturdays and these proposed Sundays or weeknights for a primary election where we may not have a lot on the ballot compared to a general election. This bill currently requires the same number of hours for all elections. So we welcome the opportunity to continue that conversation with folks involved in this legislation, but we are very supportive of the premise of early voting, and we look forward to working with the author to continue it moving forward. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. I'm going to turn now to public testimony. I have a note that there's a Mike Dean who wishes to testify. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Mike Dean. I'm the executive director of LEAD-MN. We represent the 100,000 community and technical college students in the state of Minnesota. I'm here today to urge you to support House File 558 because it'll make voting more accessible for every Minnesotan, but especially for community college students. Since no-excuse absentee balloting was approved a decade ago, more and more Minnesotans vote on the day that is most convenient for them. Then in 2020, early voting exploded because of the pandemic. For example, in our colleges, in 2018, 67% of University of Minnesota students voted on Election Day. That number then shrank to almost 30% in 2020. And at Central Lakes College, students voted at 86% rate in person. And then in 2018, that number went down to 61%. So it shows you the appetite there is for early voting. We hear from students that they want options on when to vote. Some like voting on Election Day. Others like to find a more convenient time that works for them. That's why we appreciate the section of that allows cities and counties to open up additional voting locations. This clarifies an important part of state statute on whether cities and counties can open up these pop-up locations. In fact, it would allow them to open up these locations at senior centers, community centers, and community colleges. In fact, we actually piloted such an idea in Ramsey County in 2018, and that helped 250 students vote and boosted the campus voter turnout by 5 percentage points. That election site brought students together in a room that helped them be prepared for voting by checking to see if they are registered, view a sample ballot, and see who was on the ballot for them to vote for. They could look up information on the candidates, and we assisted them in doing same-day registration if they weren't registered. But most importantly, it created a fun environment that made the voting experience enjoyable that would likely create lifetime voters. After the success of this effort, the vast majority of community college campuses in Minnesota have expressed interest in also having an early voting site on their campus, and this legislation would allow us to do that. We thank Representative Frederick for bringing forward this bill to make voting accessible, safe, and secure in Minnesota.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there other members of the public who wish to testify on this bill? Okay, seeing none, we'll turn to member discussion. Representative Bliss.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's just a logistical question. So right now we do absentee balloting. So you go in, 45 days ahead of election, you fill out your absentee ballot, you drop it in a box, and you go home. I don't know why we would need in-person pre-election balloting if we already have that, but that's beside the point. The question I have is, with the absentee balloting, your precincts and everything's listed on there, and when they open them up, they separate them. How does that work with the in-person early balloting? If you go in and you fill out your ballot and you stick it in the tabulator, how does it know what precinct? I mean, obviously, you're going to have to get the ballot for your precinct, but I guess how do they separate that? Sorry, I should have silenced that.
Representative Frederick.
My answer to that would be the same way that on election day itself. It's exactly the same. You go through the same process, and you cast your ballot and you put your ballot in the tabulator after you voted.
Representative Bliss.
So in my county, Beltrami County, there are several outside precincts that have their own tabulators. They then send those to the county and get counted, and that's where your total for the county comes in. So are you saying that this law will require all the places that have in-person balloting on election day to have in-person balloting early?
Representative Frederick?
The different precincts, I'm sorry. So the different townships and all that stuff.
The goal... thank you, Mr. Chair. The goal of this legislation is that statewide we establish a system where every voter across the state can vote in person early, 18 days prior to the election.
Representative Bliss.
Okay, so back to my initial question. The way it currently works with in-person balloting, and maybe I'm missing, I tried to scan through the bill. The way it works now is I go into my precinct, yep, fill out my ballot, scan it. It goes to the county. It's separated out on the totals by precinct. This precinct voted for Matt 100% of the time. I wish I had more of those, but, Anyways, so then it gets reported to the state, and it's broken down by precinct. In Beltrami County, I don't know how many townships I have, and I know the city of Bemidji has five precincts. How is that broken? Right now, there's only one place in Beltrami County to cast your early ballot, and that's the courthouse. In this bill, are you saying that it goes out? Okay. I saw the light bulb.
Yeah.
Sorry, it's early.
Okay. I think that was an affirmative. Representative Frederick?
Sorry. I think I'm understanding the question now. Thank you. This does not say that you have to set up all of the different locations within the county. That I think quite often what we will see is in the county seat where you will see just that one location. However, it does allow the different pop-up locations, as we've heard testimony, in my case, in Blue Earth County, if I wanted to vote early in person, I would likely be going down to the courthouse, which is the county seat, casting my vote in person in that early time prior to Election Day, whereon if I voted on Election Day, my local polling location would be or has been at my university. So what this bill does is says that I could show up to my county seat, cast my vote in person. There is the flexibility there that to allow the different locations to be set up if people should want to do that, but is not making it mandatory for all of those different locations to be open in that 18-day period.
I'm going to try one last time, and then I don't care if I get the answer.
You're missing the question.
If how does it separate the precincts in the count is my question.
Mr. Chair, I would invite the Secretary of State's office down to help with this question if they'd be willing to come down and answer this one.
Sure. Welcome back to the committee, Nicole Freeman. If you could answer that question. I know it is separated when you vote in person on Election Day as well, but I guess I don't know the logistics of that exactly.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Currently at absentee in-person locations, as would be in an early vote location, the tabulator is programmed for to read all of the ballot styles that exist in that county or in that jurisdiction. So some cities are authorized to do absentee voting. So that would also occur here. So those tabulators would read each different ballot style. So you'd still be getting your individual precinct ballot, school district, all of that, the right ballot style still. And then similar to how the ballot board's results are combined but then separated out for reporting, that would also, these results would be combined with the ballot board and then sent up to the state.
Thank you. Why don't you stay up there just in case? Okay, Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Frederick, for bringing forth this bill. So currently, how can people vote in Minnesota right now in statute?
Representative Frederick?
Currently, everyone can vote on Election Day should they want to. If they want to be part of the absentee balloting, they can request an absentee ballot and then vote via absentee. This would keep that system in place, that it should people want to be able to vote absentee. There's other legislation before the legislature on some of those other topics. But this would change it so in that 18-day period people could show up and cast a ballot in person.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So right now people can go and do early voting right now in Minnesota.
Representative Frederick.
People can absentee vote right now. What this would do is to create more ways to be able to vote. I think the goal should always be to be as accessible and easy as possible. I think that we should always be trying to get as many Minnesotans to vote as possible, as much as that we can. And so this is just another avenue to help people have their voice be heard.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So right now, people can vote early, but we're trying to make it more convenient. But here's what I'm hearing. We're trying to make it more convenient and make it the atmosphere feel better is what I'm kind of getting with this 18-day early voting win, so it feels more real, like same-day voting.
Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would say that this would allow a person's ballot to be counted right away, where absentee voting, the ballots get set to the side, get counted at a later date. And this does allow someone to be able to go in person, put their ballot in a tabulator, and have it be counted immediately.
Representative Davis.
Okay, thank you. And I won't keep this going too long because I know we press for time. So to me, this is opening up another window. Like in my district, I know for a fact, and I know we can come up with different polls. What I've noticed is polls on this subject about whether people have confidence in our elections, they vary big time, okay? And you can make a poll, say what you really wanted to say. But in my district, I know I have lots of constituents who do not have confidence in our elections right now, in the integrity of our elections. As good as the Secretary of State's office is doing, they still don't have confidence in it. And I'm wondering, Representative, how is this right here, adding one more thing, because my constituents are concerned that, okay, someone can go and do a mail-in ballot and then also show up on voting day, and so they voted twice and they won't get caught. I've had two different people that I'm aware of in my district, in my area, that they showed up on voting day, and it showed that they had already voted via mail-in ballot. And they had to sign an affidavit saying, no, we didn't do that. So people's confidence is shaken in our elections, and now we're adding one more avenue where my constituents are concerned that someone's going to vote mail-in, someone's going to vote early day, and then they're going to go vote on the day of election, and they're not going to get caught. So with that, Mr. Chair, I thank you for the time.
Yep, thank you. We may try to limit the number of follow-up questions moving forward here. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Frederick, for bringing the bell. And I just want to, I think I have a question actually for Michael Stahlberger, because it's really great to have an actual administrator but what I heard him say also, and what I have heard in our conversations, is the ability to put your ballot directly in the counter is actually something that, one, people want, and is, when it comes to the confidence that we're talking about. Putting it in an envelope, putting it aside, is actually not in people's expectations of what early voting is going to look like. And so I actually think when it comes to Representative Davids, when it comes to people's confidence, the idea that someone can show up on election day or show up a week before and have the same process, the same putting it into the ballot, is actually a confidence. When you talk to voters in your district, actually will add confidence. One of the things I actually wanted to ask you, Mr. Stahlberger, is can you just give us a sense of, because I know we have this process that sort of evolved over time, an absentee that's then been in person, and we've talked a little bit about the impact that it's had on the voters, but from an election administrator experience, maybe talk about the difference between our current system, 41 days out, and what you do when folks vote in person, absentee, versus what it would look like under this bill.
Michael Stahlberger.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. I will try to keep this brief, but I'll give you kind of a quick rundown on the absentee voting process. So under Minnesota law, we start absentee voting 46 days before the election, and that is a process that's done through envelopes, right? Folks can request a ballot online, they can request a ballot via mail, they can come to our office and fill out an application. It all requires an application to be completed. Once that application is completed, we can distribute a ballot. Those ballots come back through an enveloped process where it is inside a secrecy envelope, which is inside of a signature envelope, which is inside of a mailing envelope. Those are all kept in secure storage for us, and our ballot boards work through reconciling that to make sure that they've been returned by the voter who requested them, and then they're eventually processed the week before the election. That takes us all the way up to, under current law, the 7 days before the election. The 7 days before the election, we switch over to what's called direct balloting. Direct balloting is where we are now allowed to remove the use of envelopes, but we still have to use an application. That's where our voters under our current practices right now are confused, because they're saying, wait a minute, I think I'm voting early. Why am I filling out an application? I want to vote today. And so this bill helps us clean that up, that they're still going to be voting early, but they won't be using an application any longer, because we'll be using the same sort of systems that are used on election day to validate that voter, make sure they're eligible to vote, that they're in the right county, and that they have not voted yet in the election. Once that's occurred, then they're able to feed a ballot directly into the tabulator. And Representative, to get back to your question there specifically, that's exactly what the voter is looking for, because they want that validation that their vote has been counted, that it is in a machine, that it's securely kept, and that it is part of the record for that election. What we've also heard from our voters in this instance is that they really appreciate the ability to have the machine confirm that their votes have been cast correctly, meaning that there wasn't an overvote or there wasn't a stray mark that would make their ballot hard to be read or need to be adjudicated by a ballot board. And those are things that early voting allows us to do that the absentee ballot process by mail didn't allow us to do. Our ballot board at that point can't go back to the voter and ask them what their intent was because the ballot is secret, of course, and we separate that from who actually casts that ballot. So again, I apologize, probably way longer than you wanted, but when I start talking elections, that's where I go. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Clarification, statements have been made indicating that the same checks and balances are present during the, would be present for the early voting. What are the ones that are not present?
Representative Frederick, would you like some clarification on the question?
Please.
Okay, Representative Quam, could you elaborate a little bit on what you mean?
Well, multiple people have stated that we've got the same verification checks and balances before as after. I actually want the author to tell me which ones are not the same, which ones are absent.
Do you mean checks and balances, Representative Quam, in terms of the guarantee that the ballots are kept separate if when they're put fed directly into a machine as opposed to put into an envelope?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative.
There are processes in law that require the person can vote, they're in the right precinct, et cetera, et cetera. I would assume the author of this bill would understand all the verification and checks and balances that are the same and different, and I'd like him to illuminate that.
I'm sure he does understand those, Representative Quam. So it sounds like you're talking about checks and balances in terms of ensuring voter eligibility, that type of thing?
All of the current election day checks, balances, verification processes to ensure integrity of the election. But I mean, the author, since he's written this bill, obviously must know that. So if he would let me know.
I'm sure he does know that, Representative Quam.
Then why is the chair not letting him actually answer the question?
He asked for clarification. I was a little unclear on the question and wanted to make sure I understood it as well before I turned to him. I'm going to let him answer. I just want to make sure I understand the question. You in a good spot with the question, Representative Frederick?
Sure.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So our elections are administered in a way that is secure and one that we can have trust in. There is a huge checklist that our county elections administrators go through to ensure the accuracy of our elections. I do want to say that it is important, too, that there is not a single election nationwide whose outcome was determined by any sort of voter fraud. And so we can have faith in our elections. And as leaders, I think we need to make sure we are putting that message out there instead of spreading misinformation or election lies or sowing distrust about our election system. We have seen nationally the harm that that caused, including the loss of life, because people who want to sow that sort of distrust within our election systems.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, not one enumeration was made by the author. I asked for specifics and enumeration, not a reading of, you know, talking points.
It's Representative Quam, it is a very broad, general question, you know, what sorts of protections.
And the author cannot even do one, two, three.
Representative Quam, please do not impugn motives to the author here or a lack of knowledge. He is very knowledgeable about this bill. We just want to make sure we understand the question. I want to make sure your questions get answered.
Okay. I'll make it even more simple for the chair. No, because I'm not even getting my first one. This is not a follow-up. You had someone testify, and you even have in your bill that we need shorter hours the Monday before to allow them to the many, many checks and balances. So obviously, if they have to have extra time to get ready for election day for the many, many checks and balances, they aren't ready for the many, many checks and balances beforehand, right? Oh, we need to get ready for election day because we got many, many checks and balances. Well, if they already have the same checks and balances, they wouldn't need that, would they? And I'm just trying to make sure that the appropriate activity has been done for this bill, and the author can't enumerate that. Why do I have concerns? Because the Secretary of State and the counties, per the president of the County Auditor Association, when asked to report on the verification process for tens of thousands of bad registrations required by the Social Security Administration website for verification, which is publicly visible, and I can send the same stuff I sent 2 years ago when the Secretary of State says, well, that's not true. You know, we've audited twice. We've got that information, and they're not checking that. We don't follow, we do not follow HAVA. It'd be nice if we followed HAVA since we've got all this time, but we don't follow HAVA. One of three states that isn't following HAVA. And we've got tens of thousands of ballots possible because we have tens of thousands of registrations that were bad when using the HAVA verification site. And they haven't been.
Follow-up question.
Well, I haven't gotten the answer to my first question, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair?
I'd love to get to the follow-up question.
Frederick.
So, to the biggest difference between and what we've heard from the testifiers here is that that application process, when it is, comes to that absentee balloting, that is not required under early in-person or on election day. Like when we show up on election day, you don't have to fill out an application. That is the biggest difference between what we had versus what we are going towards with this bill. If Representative Quam would like a whole laundry list, the checklist that our county elections administrators come through to talk about the security of the equipment, we've already heard about that in committee. But if they need a reminder, that's fine. I'm sure that we have experts in this room that can talk about that checklist that they go through to make sure that our elections are secure.
Sure. I will ask Representative Frederick, and Representative Quam, I will ask the Secretary of State's office to provide us with a checklist of the checks and balances, and I will make sure it gets provided to committee members.
But there's more than the checks and balances.
Quam,
then haul me out of the committee if you're not going to allow us to actually debate the darn bill.
Representative Altendorf,
order.
Mr. Chair, you need to let us.
Representative Quam, stop it.
No! I will not allow you to ignore valid questions. I didn't even get the answer to my first question. You said, oh, no follow-ups. You need to actually cover the bill. You didn't talk about all of the things that we got with observers and challengers. You have not talked about the fact that you don't have the balance between the two parties and election judges. You have a lot of stuff that's not explained, and this is not a trivial change. And if you don't care about the quality of the bills that you include, then you really, really are not doing the service to the citizens of the state of Minnesota. And I will not sit here to a travesty of pushing through stuff that there's not the details, the author can't answer questions, and you obfuscate and don't allow us to actually cover it.
Motives, you are creating a
I am pointing out the obvious.
Okay.
I am pointing out the obvious.
The motion was to lay the bill over. So Representative Frederick has renewed the motion that House File 550.
Sure. Cut off questions. Ignore valid concerns. And you just have a.
I'm going to turn over the chair to Vice Chair Greenman. Good luck with this one, Representative Greenman.
I don't get to ask my questions.
Yeah, we can also, Representative Torkelson, is there anything, we can recess for 5 minutes if you would like to calm down here, if everything to calm down a bit. Is there anything you would like to do?
Well, Mr. Chair, there were questions on this bill that others had that we did not get a chance to ask, including Representative.
I had valid questions.
That's fine.
Yeah. If we have time at the end, let's just turn over to the other bill.
If you ask the questions, then there wouldn't be an issue.
Representative
Let's just not answer a question and ignore. Then haul me out of here if you're going to run
a
kangaroo committee.
Representative Quam, you asked a very broad question that would just, never mind. We've laid the bill over. Okay, we're going to turn over to the other.
Give me a second here. I wasn't really expecting to do this quite so quickly.
Take your time. Everybody can take a deep breath.
Yes, you have the, yes, Madam Chair.
Would you like to move your bill?
Yes, thank you. I would like to move that House File 1140 be recommended to be re-referred to the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee.
Chair Freiberg moves that House File 1140 be recommended to be re-referred to the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee. Chair Freiberg, would you like to move and describe the DE2 amendment?
Yes, I'd like to move the DE2 amendment. It'll put the bill in the shape I'd like. You know, I think it might be easier just to have it before us. Well, actually, I'm trying to think. There was a discussion from our House research saying we should consider the other amendments since they are written as amendments to the amendment. So I guess maybe I will describe the DE2 amendments just so we know what we're talking about, and then we can go right to amendments.
And just so folks are, there's a DE and there's also amendments to amendments. I think that's what we're talking about, how we're going to move forward. Do you want to describe the DE2 and then we'll get to the amendments?
Sure. I'll do the general walkthrough at this point. So the bill includes various technical and small policy items related to election administration. I'll summarize the main points of the bill, but if anyone has questions about specific sections, we can respond to those.
Mr. Chair, Lee Torkelson, did you have a question about how
did we adopt the DE?
No.
No, we have not.
We have not adopted the DE. We're describing the DE. I think then we are going to take the amendments to the amendments.
Don't want to adopt it, or I'm confused.
Yeah, our amendments to the amendment to the DE. So I think we are going to describe the DE. Chair Freiberg.
How about we just adopt the DE amendment? I think committees do it that way. There was a discussion that it should be done the way it's done on the floor, but I know committees do it this way too. So I think rather than confusing things, I think maybe it's better just to adopt the DE amendment.
Sounds good. So we're going to go forward with adopting the DE, and then you're going to describe the DE, and then we'll get to the amendments to the amendment?
Sure.
Okay. Chair Freiberg moves... moves the DE2 amendment to House File 1140. All in favor, say aye.
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 All opposed, say nay. Amendment, the DE2 is adopted. So to 1140 as amended.
Thank you. So this bill includes various technical and small policy items related to election administration. I'll summarize the main points of the bill, but if anyone has questions about specific sections, either I or the testifiers can respond to those. So by making changes to various chapters of statute, the bill expands direct balloting and the processing of absentee ballots so local jurisdictions can begin these processes 14 days before the election. In 2020, the legislature allowed ballot boards to begin opening and processing ballots 14 days prior to Election Day. This was a one-time allowance for 2020, but since then, the Office of the Secretary of State has repeatedly heard from local administrators that they would like the extension made permanent. Absentee ballots are not counted until election night. Direct balloting expansion allows a voter to insert their ballot into the tabulator for 14 days prior to election day. Voters like this option and have shown us that by turning out in the highest numbers to early vote the last 7 days before election day. Section 12 provides clarification to the challenge of voter eligibility process before election day. It provides timelines, requires evidence, details hearing protocols, and specifies the notice to the voter. Section 21 permits local elections officials to engage in absentee voting activities in assisted living facilities, state veterans' homes, and in certain shelters for battered women in the same manner as permitted in hospitals and other healthcare facilities. Section 33 allows a city and towns to adopt a resolution to determine when write-in votes must be counted. This will save time on election night while still ensuring write-in votes are individually counted when a viable write-in candidate may have received enough votes. Section 40 removes the current metro restriction and would allow towns and cities under 400 registered voters across the state to choose to vote by mail ballot. There are also two changes needed as a result of court decisions. In Section 34, there's a clarification that the existing law establishing procedure for filling a vacancy and nomination for an office does not apply to candidates for election to a federal office. This is to conform Minnesota law with the United States District Court decision invalidating the statutory section with respect to federal contests. In Section 44, this eliminates the three-person limit on the number of voters a person can assist on election day. This limit was the subject of a court decision finding that this limit was preempted by federal law and unenforceable. Sections 52 through 54 extend the period for conducting a special election to fill a vacant legislative seat by 2 weeks in cases where an expedited process is required in order to allow the person elected to be seated quickly for a legislative session. This ensures that voters in mail ballot jurisdictions and absentee voters have an opportunity to participate in the election. That's just kind of a brief summary of what the DE does. We can turn to amendments if you like.
Thank you, Chair Freiberg. Would you like to move and describe the A3 amendment to the amendment?
Sure. The A3, I'll move the A3 amendment. This was adopted in the Senate, seemed logical to me. It would allow absentee ballots to be delivered in person up until 8 p.m. on election day when the polls close.
Thank you, Chair Freiberg. Any discussion to the amendment? All in favor of the A3 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails, and the A3 amendment to the amendment is adopted. Chair Freiberg, would you like to move and describe the A4 amendment to the amendment?
The A4 amendment was adopted in the Senate as well. It allows the names of voters who have submitted absentee ballots to be made available prior to the close of voting. This relates to the list of rejected ballots.
Thank you, Chair Freiberg. Any discussion to the amendment? All in favor of the amendment, say aye.
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 All opposed? The motion prevails, and the A4 amendment to the amendment is adopted. Representative Altendorf, I think you have the next one. Would you like to move and describe the A6 amendment to the amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I would like to move that, and then you said describe it?
Yeah.
Okay, thank sorry. Okay, so this is just a small technicality, which I think makes sense, and I hope you see it that as well. But in this amendment, what I'm asking to do is to clarify where it says residents in the definition. So it says residents shall be determined in accordance with the following principles so far as they may be applicable to the facts of the case. And where I think there's gray area here is residents. So, we all know people have multiple residences and that's actually very common. So I think we need to tighten that up a little bit. And if we could just, either replace residents with reside. So that it's a actual definition that the person's living there. It's not something that they just own or visit at times. And so this is a small technicality. So what I'm suggesting is to replace residence with reside, or if you wanted to, we could just change the definition and it could be reside, right? Residence is where you reside. Like, it would be changed in the definition. Does that make sense?
Madam Chair, Representative Altendorf, let me ask Representative Freiberg, do you have a response to this or comments on
sure.
the amendment?
No, thank you, Representative Altendorf. I appreciate your attention to this. I'm not sure I'm comfortable with this at this point. So, the changes that the amendment would make would delete, I guess I should say, the whole purpose of making the change of resides to maintain residence is to create uniformity in the terminology that's used across statutes to determine where a person maintains a residence and what precinct they're eligible to vote in. And I could provide a list of places in statute the term is used if members are interested. But the term residence as it relates to voter registration is defined in statute. It's in section 200.031. So because of that, using the word residence or maintains residence helps policymakers, administrators, and voters understand how to determine their residence as it relates to voting. So I have a list of places that the term is used here, but I'm willing to work with you, Representative Altendorf. I appreciate your, you know, your thoughtful explanation, but at this point, I'm not really comfortable adopting this. I think I do think the changes that this amendment would delete will kind of create uniformity and make things easier for election administrators to understand at this point, as I've been told.
Representative Altendorf.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chair Freiberg, for that explanation. I know you said that you could work with me on this, and this is the kind of things that we really are supposed to be doing as the body, is we don't want gray area out there. This is exactly what causes these problems. And whenever we can tighten up the language so that there's not this gray area, I think we as a legislative body, we absolutely have to do that. So in my mind, this is such a simple change that I really hope that you follow up with me afterwards and that we get this done so that there is no question, because this does happen where people have a residence in one area and they're not actually residing there. And it does happen. It has happened in the past. And so we just need to tighten this up. Thank you. Am I removing my amendment? Is that what I do? No. Or it's a vote.
Representative Altendorf, you could withdraw your amendment. We could also vote on it. Sort of your choice.
We can vote on it.
Okay. Any further discussion to the amendment? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say nay.
No.
The motion is not adopted. Representative or Chair Freiberg, I think we are to 1140 as amended to your bill. Right?
Thank you, Madam Chair. You might want to see if anyone wants to testify
on
it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for doing this with me. It looks like you have testifiers. Welcome back, Nicole Freeman from the Office of Secretary of State.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Nicole Freeman, Office of the Secretary of State. I'm excited to be here today to discuss House File 1140. This bill is a product that incorporates ideas from the last several years from a variety of stakeholders, including local governments, community partners, and voters. Included are highly technical changes, small policy changes to expand voter access and improve election administration, as well as modernization, so statute better reflects how elections are administered in today's world. On the technical front, it makes needed updates to statute due to court decisions and creates continuity and clarity in terminology across election statutes. Beyond the technical components of this bill, it expands voter access by extending the option for local jurisdictions to administer direct balloting beginning 14 days before the election. Additionally, it expands the deadlines for requesting an agent delivery ballot and for any voter to return their absentee ballot on Election Day. It also eases the administrative burden and timeline crunch for auditors, clerks, and ballot boards by allowing them the opportunity to begin opening the absentee ballots 14 days before the election. It has been several years since a robust technical or administrative bill has been passed relating to election law, and so this bill includes several provisions to clarify and update statute to reflect how we administer elections today. Thank you very much, and I look forward to the discussion.
Thank you, Ms. Freeman. Next on my list is Michael Stahlberger from MACO. Welcome back to the committee. Please state your name for the record. Proceed.
Good morning again, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Michael Stahlberger, Blue Earth County Property and Environmental Resources Director, and representing the Minnesota Association of County Officials today. MACO does support many of the provisions listed in House File 1140 as amended. They further many of our principles and goals that we've already discussed this morning. We do want to point out a few provisions in the bill that are of most importance to our association, and so to save some time, I will run through just those for you. Section 1 regarding having the Secretary of State's office mail out balloting materials for our voters that are enrolled in the Safe at Hope program will create a lot of efficiencies and reduce the redundancy of work there, so we support that. As for Section 20, MACO fully supports the 14 days of direct balloting, which has been mentioned as an alternative if early voting does not become law. This is a significant priority for our association, and that also goes hand in hand with the processing of those ballots, not counting the results, but being able to open those envelopes and have them prepared starting 2 weeks before the election will allow us to better manage our workloads to make sure that we can have our results all set to go on election evening. Section 33 regarding the write-in candidates for city and local contests will also aid in the speed of reporting results on election night, so our association fully supports that. In regards to Section 39, expanding local decision-making and control for the use of mail ballot voting, our association does support that in allowing that to occur statewide. However, we would also encourage the author to consider allowing any city to participate in that, not having it have a threshold of 400 voters as a maximum. Section 57 is one I want to draw specific attention to. This is something our association has worked on for quite some time, and that's in regards to the sample ballot publication. We've heard from our voters for many years that the sample ballot is confusing in the way that it's required to be published under current law. This proposal will allow us as an association to work with the Secretary's office to come up with a sample ballot that is actually meaningful for voters so that they can understand and be prepared for Election Day. And so we are very supportive of that provision. The last section I'll draw attention to that we support is Section 64, which adds clarification around the availability of textual data. That is a mouthful describing what most folks know as cast voter records. This provision will make it clear and provide us with some needed guidance when responding to data requests in regards to what is public and what is not. The text files of the results of the election will be public with some restrictions to make sure that voter secrecy is maintained. But it also is also very clear that the images will not be public. Again, this clarification will help us as administrators better respond to data requests timely and to be more efficient in sharing information. One provision that we are disappointed didn't make the final cut here, and we do believe it'll come back in later discussions, is an amendment that would have allowed voter choice when it comes to assisted voting equipment. There are some pieces of technology that need additional approval to be utilized in our elections that our voters have been asking for to give them that ultimate choice, and we would look forward to working with you on that. I will point out just two sections that our association does have some questions on. There are sections related to the UOCAVA absentee voting process, and we are adding utility workers into that definition of who is deployed for purposes of UOCAVA absentee voting. As this moves forward, we would just need some administrative clarification and would like to work on what that actually means for how we would implement that as elections administrators. And then finally, we'll point out for our partners at the city level that Section 28 and the expansion of healthcare facility outreach voting will create a pretty extensive additional workload and cost to our city elections clerks who are responsible for that healthcare facility outreach. And so we would want to make sure that we work through some of those administrative hurdles to make that as efficient as possible. So in closing, we are supportive as an association of House File 1140 as amended. I appreciate the opportunity to talk today. We look forward to continue working on this, and we will gladly answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Stahlberger. That's the end of my list. Are there any members of the public that wish to testify on this bill? Seeing none, I think we will turn to discussion. Representative Altendorf.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Chair Freiberg. Okay, I had a question on eliminating the cap of assisting three voters per election. And can you explain why we would be removing that cap?
Chair Freiberg.
Thank you, Representative Altendorf. Thank you, Madam Chair. This was the result of some litigation that I believe found that that three-person limit to be unconstitutional. If you want more details about the litigation, I might ask Nicole Freeman to come back. But I guess, Representative Altendorf, did you want more information about that litigation?
Madam
Representative Altendorf.
Oh, sorry. Madam Chair, yes. If there's litigation, if she could just explain that really quick, that'd be great.
Sure. Ms. Freeman, state your name for the record. Maybe address the question.
Nicole Freeman, Office of the Secretary of State. Yes, so what Chair Freiberg said is correct. It was a, there was a court case in 2020 that was settled in 2020 that deemed that it violated federal law, as federal law allows for a voter to choose anyone to assist them to vote. And so if Minnesota has this restriction on the number of people, it could preclude a voter from having a free choice of who they would like to assist them to vote. And so that's why they deemed that we needed to make this, that it was unenforceable because it violated federal law.
Representative Altendorf.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Nicole. Yeah, I was not aware of that, so I really appreciate the explanation of that. And then just one more question. Thank you, Madam Chair. On this, I think it challenges someone's eligibility or, you know, in that case. And who is able to challenge someone's eligibility? That was part of the bill. If I don't know which.
Chair Freiberg or Ms. Freeman?
Thank you, Madam Chair members. So I think you might be talking about the section that clarifies and provides some additional structure around challenging a voter ahead of Election Day. Yep. A Minnesotan and eligible voter can challenge a voter ahead of Election Day. And these updates just clarify a timeline for that to happen. It does not remove challenges that could be issued on Election Day to challenge someone's voter eligibility.
Representative Altendorf, does that answer the question?
Just one follow-up. So, Madam Chair, Nicole, anyone can challenge the eligibility. Is that correct? I just wanted to clarify that.
Ms. Freeman.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. So the challenge of voter eligibility is based on personal knowledge or some other evidence as we listed in the bill. I'm just looking for the section that.
Okay, yeah, it's a big bill, so there's a lot of information in this one. So, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Altendorf. Any further questions? Representative Freiberg, any final comments?
No, I think these are common sense changes. I appreciate the questions and happy to work with anybody who has questions about any of the provisions in the bill. So I guess just with that, I will renew the motion that House File 1140 as amended be recommended to be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee.
Chair Freiberg renews his motion that House File 1140 as amended be recommended to be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. The motion prevails. On to the next bill. House File 2392 is also yours, Chair Freiberg. Would you like to move your bill?
Yes. Quick question. When I renewed my motion just before, did I use the correct bill number? Did I say 1140 or 2392?
For 1140. I think you said 1140, but we could. I think you said 1140.
Okay, thanks. Okay, I turned the page and forgot I did that. So thank you. Yes, I will move House File 2392 be recommended to be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee.
Chair Freiberg moves House File 2392 be recommended to be re-referred to Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. I believe there is an A2 amendment. Representative Stevenson, would you like to move and describe the A2 amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will move the A2 amendment, which, if it does what I think it does, adds lost and stolen materials to the list of non-campaign expenditures. Essentially, I think that if a campaign committee, thank you, sir, if a campaign committee has to replace something due to, you know, bad actions or misfortune, that shouldn't count against the spending limit.
Any discussion? Chair Freiberg.
Yes, this is a friendly amendment. I've run it by the Campaign Finance Board, and they're okay with it too. I think it makes sense.
All in favor of the A2 amendment, say aye.
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 All opposed? The motion prevails, and the aid to amendment is adopted. Chair Freiberg, to the bill.
Thank you. So this is a campaign finance board agency bill that clarifies a bunch of laws related to campaign spending, and I'll summarize those. Thank you, Representative Torkelson, for signing on as a co-author to this bill. Section 1 makes changes to the non-campaign disbursement section of statutes, adding recount costs and transitional office costs, and with the adoption of the amendment, lost or stolen campaign property. Section 2 extends the time frame in which an individual or committee that is the subject of a complaint has to respond. Some investigations are complicated. They require securing bank records, hiring legal representation, taking depositions. A complete response cannot always be provided in 45 days, so this increases it to 60 days. Section 3 adds a fix related to ballot question committees. There's a penalty provided if an independent expenditure committee or fund makes a contribution to a candidate, but current language does not extend that penalty to a ballot question committee that contributes to a candidate. Section 4 is a cleanup to help the reporting of contributions made to Hennepin County candidates and ballot question committees. Section 5 adds language related to cryptocurrency. Chapter 10A does not contain any guidance on cryptocurrency. Board staff has tried to help committees that have already received Bitcoin contributions, but regulation is needed. The focus in the language here is on the value of the cryptocurrency at the time of contribution, and that represents the intent of the donor. Any gain that occurs in the 5 days is reported as miscellaneous income, and loss is reported as an expenditure, so not creating artificial violations and affecting the bank account balance. Section 6 clarifies that a pre-primary report must be filed regardless of whether the city has a primary election. Section 7 clarifies the law when a political committee, candidate committee, or party unit sells goods or services to the public. The current language requires a sign in immediate proximity of the point of sale. There's been arguments over what that means. The new requirement would just be within 3 feet of the point of sale. There's also guidance in the bill on how to provide notice for web-based sales. Section 8 clarifies the law related to multi-candidate political party expenditures. Certain expenditures to promote candidates by party units do not count as a contribution to the candidate if the expenditure benefits three or more candidates. Sample ballots and phone banks are examples under current statute. The bill expands that list to include county or state fair booths run by a party unit. The treasurer will not have to determine what percentage of the table area for the literature of each candidate constitutes a contribution. Finally, Section 9 clarifies the penalty for failing to close caption campaign advertisements or provide radio scripts on a website. Candidates that sign public subsidy agreements must close caption television advertisements and provide scripts of radio advertisements on the candidate's website. However, there's no penalty provided, so the bill would establish a $1,000 maximum civil penalty. And just to note, the board rarely actually uses a maximum penalty for a first-time expense. There were violations at the past election, however, where the board could only determine that a violation occurred, but there was no penalty possible under the law. So it's a pretty technical bill. I think it's pretty straightforward. It has bipartisan support, and I would encourage members to support it. And happy to turn it over to Mr. Sigurdsson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Sigurdsson, you're on call for any questions. Are there any members of the public who would wish to testify before moving to discussion? Moving to discussion of the bill. Any discussion? Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Freiberg, for bringing this bill forward. And thank you, Mr. Sigurdsson, for spending some time with us prior to today to help us understand the bill as presented. I think we should just spend a little time on the virtual currency section of the bill for those of us that are not well versed in the world of bitcoins and other virtual currency, and since this is something that's really brand new to the statute, I think it'd be I just would like you to explain in layman's terms or old guy's terms just how this Bitcoin stuff might affect our campaign finance.
Thank you, Lead Torkelson, Mr. Sigurdsson. Old guy terms explanation of the Bitcoin provision or the virtual currency provision.
Now, thank you, Madam Chair. Jeff Sigurdsson, Executive Director of the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. Representative Torkelson, this is something that has come to staff four or five times during the 2022 election, and I think will be something that we see more so going forward, is that contributions are coming in through Bitcoin or some other type of cryptocurrency. And the question is, okay, now what do I do with this? This provision doesn't prohibit the committee or party unit or political committee from receiving the contribution, but it's trying to acknowledge that there's a lot of volatility when you receive that type of contribution. Within a very short period of time, the value might go over the excess or the maximum contribution limit that you can receive from that contributor if you're with a candidates committee, or it may drop. In either case, then what does the committee do? So what this is trying to do is provide that, one, it has to be deposited, converted in the U.S. currency and deposited in the committee's account within 5 days. We think the 5 days helps the treasurer because they may not be immediately able to attend to the virtual currency contribution, but it sets a limit so that there isn't going to be as much fluctuation within that relatively short period of time. Two, we do want to get it into the account of the committee, because that's how the board is able to audit and make sure that we understand all the contributions and expenditures that are being made by that committee. If it's not put into the committee and the expenditures are made directly with the Bitcoin after it's been received, then there's the possibility that we wouldn't be able to audit that and understand, again, if there was potentially a violation of the expenditure limit or of the contribution limit. So, again, it's important to get it into the campaigns committee so it's reported with all the other amounts of contributions and expenditures made by that committee. As Representative Freiberg mentioned, there is a procedure here to try to deal with the fact that a $2,000, or to make it relevant to committee members, to a $1,000 contribution that you may receive, that would be the maximum. 3 days later, maybe it's worth $1,100. Does that, you know, automatically create a contribution problem or a contribution limit violation for your committee? The board doesn't think so. As long as it's dealt with within that 5 days, clearly the intent of the contributor was only $1,000. So we want to have a procedure here that will account for that additional amount coming in, or additional increase in valuation that doesn't impact or cause what I would say is kind of a false violation. It wasn't intended by the committee when it accepted the contribution. It wasn't intended by the contributor. So we're having a process here where it's moved into the committee, but it's treated as miscellaneous income and not counted against that contribution limit. And then the same process, if there's a loss, is it's just going to be shown as an expenditure, but it doesn't allow for an additional contribution from that individual if they've already maxed out. Just in general, this is, you know, a new area for the board as well, and we're just trying to provide provisions here that will allow committees to understand what they're supposed to do when they receive this type of contribution.
Thank you, Mr. Secretson. Representative Torkelson, follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, a quick follow-up. So this kind of centers around the conversion process. I've never converted a Bitcoin. Is that something you do at the bank or you do online? I'm kind of a paper and pen check guy, maybe a credit card, but just how does that fit into the scheme of things?
Mr. Secretson.
Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, the process, as I understand it, is that you would receive the contribution in what amounts to as a virtual wallet. There are certain, I'm not sure if institutions is the right word, but there are certain entities which are recognized by the U.S. Department of Treasury as having the authority to convert Bitcoin in the U.S. currency. They have procedures in place that make sure that they understand the identity of the contributor and provide that to the entity that receives the contribution. So it goes through that process, which is, again, regulated by the U.S. Department of Treasury, to make sure there's information gathered on who the actual contributor was.
Lee Torkelson.
Thank you. So just to try and put it in old guy terms, this five-day window is the critical period of time that these Bitcoins must be converted into U.S. currency and then deposited within that time window. Is that the way it reads?
Mr. Sigurdsson.
Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, yes, sir, that's correct.
So there's no, excuse me, Madam Chair.
Lee Torkelson.
Thank you. So there's no option for me to take a pile of Bitcoins and put them in my pocket and wait 30 days or a year from now to cash them in and Great gain that I'm sure I would get.
Mr. Sigurdsson, I don't think that you need to address whether you can actually put Bitcoins in your pocket.
Madam Chair, Representative Urkelson, perhaps more generally, I would say that's exactly what we're trying to avoid is having it being kept by the individual. It has to be moved into the committee's account to avoid that problem.
Thank you for that clarification.
Any further discussion, Representative Davidson?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and it has to do with Bitcoin. So I'm wondering if there's anybody in this room that might have Bitcoin. I believe you have to have. Thank you. Maybe she could, because I believe you have to set up an account to even receive Bitcoin, correct?
Representative Bonner, if you, and I know we have another bill after this, and this is a titillating discussion about Bitcoin. So if you have a quick response to that, and then maybe we should all do a little primer after committee.
Well, I can't actually answer that question, although that is not why I was raising my hand. Oh. I actually had a question to the bill. Oh. But, yes, you do have to have an account. So,
Representative Bonner, to your question.
Okay, thank you. Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Freiberg and Mr. Sigurdsson. So I do appreciate, first of all, I had a lot of reservations about this particular provision, and I do see that some of the concerns that I have been addressed in this language. But that said, I want to go on record for one, saying that I think this is a transparency issue. And I think we talk a lot about making sure that voters feel confident and that they feel like we're doing the right thing, especially when it comes to finance. Bitcoin is a really gray area. It is still a little bit untested. The validity of those amounts, the fluctuations in those amounts, leads to a lot of uncertainty. And I'm going to go on record as saying I still have serious and grave concerns about including virtual currencies as an acceptable form of donation for campaigns. So I want to be clear about that. That said, under the lines 5.28 to 5.29, we talk specifically about if you donate the currency and then you convert it within that five-day window, right? And we talked about the scenario in which, let's say you make a $1,000 donation, which is a maximum donation, and you find that when you do in fact put it in, you get $1,100, right? So it comes out $100 over the maximum contribution. In this section, it says it must be reported as a receipt, but not a contribution. So I guess I'm a little nervous about that part. So just for clarification purposes, does that mean that that $100 that is over the value of a maximum contribution under campaign finance law must be returned to the individual who made that donation so that we are not in violation of campaign finance law?
Mr. Sigurdsson.
Madam Chair, Representative, not under the provisions of this bill. This is basically acknowledging that the contributor's intent when they made the virtual the cryptocurrency conversion or contribution, was to make the maximum contribution. They said, okay, the maximum's $1,000. I'm donating to you $1,000 cryptocurrency contribution. The treasurer takes 2 days, 3 days to actually process it, convert the U.S. currency, and now, as you state, for whatever reason, it's now worth $1,100. We don't think that was the intent of the contributor. We don't believe penalizing the contributor and or the committee for accepting the contribution that has now converted itself into something that's over the maximum level is appropriate. Instead, we would say, all right, that additional $100 in this example is going to be treated as miscellaneous income and not counted against the contribution limit.
Representative Bonner, quick follow-up, and we do have another bill.
Thank you. So just to be clear, I have had folks make donations to my campaign and inadvertently go over the limit, right? It is very clear that their intent was to donate only the maximum allowed under the law. And in my campaign, and I assume in everyone else's, it is incumbent upon me and my treasurer then to right that wrong and to refund the overage to the individual who made that contribution to make sure that we're always on the right side of the law, that we are not accepting funds that we should not be accepting. And I guess my major problem with this provision is that if we are not clear that any overage is being returned to that contributor, I find that problematic. So I will go on record as saying I have problems with this entire section of virtual donation because I just think it's risky. And the other issue is that the language as it's written right now does not make clear that we are being as transparent with those dollars as we should be for the general public, and I think that's a risk. And so I just want to be clear about that, and I would suggest that if this has any further stops or the opportunity that we either find a way to amend the statute to be clear so that we have a level playing field for everyone when it comes to the finances, or we simply eliminate this at this time and do not allow for this. Thank you.
Chair Freiberg, and I think that Lee Torkelson has a question, and then I think.
Sure. Yeah, thank you. And thank you, Representative Bonner. This is going to the Judiciary Committee, and I do expect it could reappear here and as part of some larger bill. So I'm happy to keep working with you on this. You know, as Director Sigurdsson mentioned, these contributions are already happening. So the goal is just to put and there's no regulations in place. So the goal is to put some regulations in place. You raised a point about whether cryptocurrency should be accepted in a campaign context at all. I think that's a fair question that we should discuss. It's kind of a larger policy discussion that I think we might want to have. But in terms of, you know, this technical bill, I think just getting some basic regulations in place is a good thing to do in the meantime. But as I said, we can still continue to tweak them as this moves forward, even those.
Thank you, Chair Freiberg. And Lee Torkelson, final question.
A couple of quick comments. One, you know, the gain on something like this, I do believe, is appropriately classified as miscellaneous income. It's really nobody's fault that the Bitcoin gained value in that five-day period. And, Madam Chair, I have to apologize for the sexist remark I made earlier regarding old men. I should have included mature women.
Thank you, Lee Torkelson. It sounds like we need a study group on Bitcoin after this. But I think that seeing no further discussion, Chair Freiberg, do you have any closing comments before we move on to the next bill?
I couldn't have made any better closing comments than Lee Torkelson, so I'll just leave it at that, and I'll renew my motion that House File 2392, as amended, is recommended to be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee.
Chair Freiberg renews the motion that House File 2392, as amended, be re-referred to Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say nay. The motion prevails. On to your next bill. Chair Freiberg, would you like to move House File 2393.
Thank you. I will move that House File 2393 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill.
Chair Freiberg moves that House File 2393 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Chair Freiberg, to your bill.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Greenman. This bill updates the statutes related to lobbying. At least in the other body, it has bipartisan support. And there has been an increasing realization that the public was not getting good value for the money spent on the disclosure program for lobbying. The information currently provided is about the administrative costs related to lobbying, cell phone bills, copier costs. Our statutes even include a reference to telegraph costs. Should give you a hint as to the time they were put into law. But these costs provide no insight into the issues that associations that hire lobbyists are supporting or opposing. The board has worked for 3 years with the Minnesota Government Relations Council to develop a new reporting approach that would provide meaningful disclosure and a reporting requirement which the lobbying community can understand and comply with. The new reporting approach requires disclosure of the governmental unit being lobbied and the subjects of interest for the association represented by the lobbyist. The bill creates disclosure for four types of lobbying: legislative action, action by a metropolitan governmental unit, administrative action, and action by the Public Utilities Commission. A fiscal note was requested and provided in the other body. There's no increase in board staffing or operational budget needed. It's a pretty straightforward bill, so I'm happy to turn it over to anyone who would like to testify.
Thank you, Chair Freiberg. It looks like Mr. Eric Hyland from the Minnesota Government Relations Council has signed up to testify. Please state your name for the record and proceed with an interest in time.
Of course, Madam Chair. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on House File 2393. For the record, my name is Eric Hyland, and I'm here today representing the Minnesota Government Relations Council. I'm also a past president of this professional organization. For those of you that are not familiar with MGRC, it is the trade association that represents over 500 government relations professionals in Minnesota. We provide advocacy, professional development, and we believe the importance of ethical representation in public policy process. We have a code of ethics that's available on our website and in the directory, and adherence is required by our members. Many of you may recognize the directory that we issue each year. We appreciate the willingness of Mr. Segerson to work with us in refining the campaign finance board proposal that's contained in this bill. And as a result, MGRC has no objections to the legislation as introduced. Thank you again, Madam Chair and members, and we appreciate the time.
Thank you, Mr. Hyland. Do any other members of the public wish to testify? Seeing none, any member discussion to the bill? Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will be brief, partly because I'm plugging my own bill in the process, but I would just remind members of the committee and members of the public that activities that we consider to be lobbying activities at the local level do not require everyone to register as a lobbyist. If I were a lobbyist and lobbied my own city council member or Representative Greenman's in Minneapolis, I would have to register as a lobbyist. Because right now, if I were to lobby, literally any other member of this committee's city council members or township board members or county commissioners, I would not, because currently lobbying statute only applies to metro area governments with more than 50,000 people. And I think if we are talking about transparency, if we're talking about what it means to lobby and what the people of Minnesota expect from that transparency, I think it should apply across the board. So that's just my plug for my bill is all. Thank you.
Representative Coulter. Representative Kwan.
A clarification on that, since Rochester is the third largest city and is over 50,000, but is not part of the actual metro designated counties, is Rochester included in that?
Representative Kwan and Representative Coulter, if you can answer quickly. I think we're talking about a bill that's not before us right now, so if you can answer quickly and then we can get back to this bill.
The answer is no, Rochester is not included then. It is literally only metro area local governments with more than 50,000 people.
Any further discussion to this bill? Seeing none, Representative or Chair Freiberg, do you want to any final comments on your bill?
Thank you. The data the reports that are out there on lobbyists are rarely accessed by the public, and I think this will help make them more useful. I think it's a good government bill, and with that, I will renew the motion that House File 2393 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill.
Chair Freiberg renews the motion that House File 2393 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. The bill is laid over. Chair Freiberg, do you want me to hand you back the gavel with?
Okay. Okay, Representative Torkelson's shaking his head, so I think we're good, and I think we can adjourn.
Okay. Seeing no further business, we are adjourned. Yep.